For most of us, a bout of the flu is just another fact of life. We've all caught it more than once, and most of us come out of it okay, yet we live in fear of another global pandemic, of an influenza virus like the 1918 Spanish, quote-unquote, flu pandemic, which killed, as we've discussed on the program previously, somewhere between 50 and 100 million people worldwide. Now, back in 1918, they treated the flu with everything from chloride gas to bloodletting to chicken soup. But according to our next guest, despite all the scientific advancements of the 20th and, well, 21st century, we're not much closer to figuring out a way to stop the flu. And yes, that includes the infamous Tamiflu. Now, this is something that could come back to haunt us in another big outbreak. As I told you earlier, Jeremy Brown is currently at the National Institute of Health in the United States, where he directs his Office of Emergency Care Research. He's experienced the influenza from both sides, as an emergency room doctor and as a patient. And he's been researching the story behind our hunt for a cure for influenza. It's part of his new book, Influenza, The Quest to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History. And Jeremy joins us now from Washington, D.C. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you and good evening.
It may surprise people that you bill flu as the deadliest disease in history. People would assume it was either malaria or cancer.
Yes, I think the reason for that is, as you mentioned in your introduction, you know, most of us experience the flu as a somewhat of a minor irritation. It knocks us out for 2 or 3 days. We're in bed for that period of time. And we slowly recover. Hopefully we have a friend or family member that can look in on us and give us some warm soup to help get us through. And then we recover, and that's really as far as it goes for the majority of us, and that's really a good thing. But for a small number, and we do have to remember that it is a small number of patients, the flu can develop into some complications, and that can lead to people having to visit the emergency room be hospitalized, and in very extreme cases, go to the intensive care unit, and people can indeed die from this. So we think of influenza as a somewhat mild disease, but in the background is this constant gnawing away at people. So in the US, for instance, it is estimated, and it's not a perfect estimate, but it's estimated that between 30 and 50,000 people in the US die each year from the flu. If we look back at the figures for 1918, the estimates are somewhere between 50 and 100 million people. And so over the years, and including that epidemic, it is certainly the worst infectious disease epidemic that we know of in human history.
Do we, this is a silly way to phrase it, but is there evidence of flu in ancient times? Does it pop up in the fossil record?
It doesn't pop up in the fossil record, but there is certainly evidence of flu in ancient times. There is a story that was actually mentioned by the ancient Greek historian Thucydides, and he compiled a history of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, and he wrote that around 430 BC. And he describes a disease which he said there was an overwhelming fever in the head and redness in the eyes, and then he said it was followed by sneezing and coughing, and he describes this disease as killing a third of the 13,000 soldiers that were then stationed in Athens. And when people have looked at this disease, there are some people who've believed that this is a description of influenza, a very good description of influenza, coming to an abrupt end as it did with the change in the weather. And so some people believe that this is actually probably the earliest description of influenza in the human record that we have. So it certainly goes back almost 3,000 years and perhaps longer.
In programs we've done on flu over the last 20 or 30 years, We have often discussed the great epidemic, pandemic of 1918, and that very rubbery figure of 50 to 100 million. But as I recall, the figures in Western Europe were pretty well known, but they get very vague, don't they, when you start looking towards India or China?
Yes, you're right, and that's why the estimates are so wide. I mean, was it 50? Was it 100? A million. We'll never know for sure. But even if you take the low estimate, it is still a number that is very, very hard to get your head around. I mean, if we focus on Australia, for example, the epidemic reached Australia in early 1919. So we really are now in the 100th anniversary of the great flu in Australia. It came in two waves between March and May of 1919. There was a first wave that accounted for about 30% of all the people who would die. It was followed by a more virulent second wave between June and July of 1919. And when it was all said and done, about 15,000 people were dead in Australia and about 2 million affected. Now, you say 2 million affected, the entire population of Australia in 1918 was about 5 million people. So almost a third, or getting towards a half of the population of Australia was in some way or another affected by this flu epidemic.
Jeremy, I understand it had a particular impact on indigenous populations here and elsewhere.
Yes, that's right. The indigenous populations, the best estimates are that they suffered a 50% mortality. But if you, I just want to say that if you put the numbers of dead in the great flu epidemic of 1918 into numbers of today, given the population growth, there would be that would equate to about 75,000 deaths in Australia today if you put the numbers into today's population. So it was a devastating epidemic, and this despite very good efforts to quarantine Australia as they realized that the flu was heading their way from Europe.
I mentioned in introducing you that in 1918 some of the treatments for flu, including chloride gas, bloodletting and chicken soup.
Yes, that's actually the way that I became interested in this whole topic. I like to spend my time reading history and medical history, and I came across a report that had been published in 1916 of an influenza outbreak actually in Britain. And that one, the report said that it was a bad outbreak, and that doctors had tried bloodletting. As you mentioned, this is the
there was almost a universal response to all forms of illness, wasn't it?
That's right. That's right. And it goes back to the time of Hippocrates. And it's over 2,000 years old. It was a mainstay of high-tech medicine for a couple of thousand years. But the realization that the British physicians had tried bloodletting in 1916, that really scratched my head. And I looked a little bit further into this. And there are reports of doctors using it on patients who suffered from the great flu itself in 1918 and 1919. So that was quite a shocking discovery. I said, this is really was going on in the age of my, when my own grandfather was alive. So that's what I looked into. That's what encouraged me to look into this whole story and resulted in the book. But you are, as you mentioned, some of the treatments for influenza 100 years ago were mercury, tree bark, aspirin in huge quantities. Whiskey seemed very popular, so I suppose there was some relief to patients. Doctors often prescribed whiskey. Enemas, everybody got enemas back then. It was thought to be a good cleanse. Bloodletting, as you mentioned. And these were the state-of-the-art treatments, and it leaves one wondering if perhaps the doctors were somewhat responsible for the deaths as well as the influenza virus itself.
Talking to Jeremy about his book Influenza, The Quest to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History, I learned from you that we didn't really know that it was a virus until much later in the 1950s.
That's right. The puzzling thing about influenza back in 1918 was that nobody knew what the cause was. And in many ways, this, I think, is the most frightening feature of the disease, that people were dying in these large numbers, especially young, healthy adults, for reasons that we might want to talk about later. The disease affected young, healthy adults in unusually high proportions. And nobody had a clue what the cause was. Viruses wouldn't be discovered until the 1930s. They figured out that it was something that was smaller than a bacteria, but were not sure what that something was. So you had this epidemic and not a clue as to what it was. And if you didn't have a clue as to what it was caused by, you couldn't make a vaccine or talk about ways to sort of get on top of the outbreak. And so it was really, I think, it must have been a very, very frightening time.
We'll put the virus under the microscope thoroughly in a minute, but you mentioned in passing that it was particularly deadly to young people. Now, that's counterintuitive.
It is. The people who get complications from the flu are generally the very young and the elderly, and those with chronic conditions. But for some reason, the flu of 1918 attacked young, healthy people in, as I said, very, very high proportions. Now, we're not really sure why that happened, but one of the reasons that scientists are so interested in the virus today is that if they can figure out what made it so deadly back then, we can prepare ourselves for another epidemic of a similar threat. And so understanding why middle-aged, young, healthy adults were attacked is still a little bit of a puzzle.
Now, according to Jurassic Park, you can get DNA out of insects in aspic. Is it possible to actually study a 1918 virus?
It is, and it was a little bit of a Jurassic Park-like adventure that led us to actually having real samples, if you like, live samples of the virus. There had been an attempt back in the 1950s to dig some bodies out of the Arctic tundra to take samples of their lungs and look for the virus there. The reason that people went to the Arctic was that the Arctic tundra, is extremely cold and would preserve bodies well. So there was an attempt in the 50s to extract the virus from the bodies that were there. It didn't work. They were unable to retrieve the virus. But in the 90s, there was another expedition actually led by the same man, Johan Hultin. And he was able then to extract the virus from some bodies that he had exhumed with the permission of the village elders in Alaska. And when those samples were sent back to Washington for analysis, they were able to reconstruct the viral gene from those particles that they had found. So we do actually have copies of the 1918 virus today. They are stored in research freezers, and scientists do experiment on them, as I said, to try and understand what made it so deadly and how we can prevent it going forward.
If we go back to 1918, there were doctors who were so desperate to understand the flu that they infected themselves with it.
Yes, this is an example, I think, of remarkable selflessness on behalf of lots of people, and this story that you mentioned involves a professor called Yamanuchi, who found 52 doctors and nurses who helped try and fight the flu by becoming guinea pigs. What the professor did was he took some sputum from influenza patients and placed it on the noses of these volunteers. Some received the goop directly, get your head around that, and in others they received it after it was worn through a filter that would capture all the bacteria. And because both groups got the influenza, they were able to conclude that whatever the cause was, it was something that was smaller than a bacteria. But again, to think of the selflessness of a group of physicians and nurses at a time when this was a deadly disease, nobody knew what it was caused by, and there was no cure, and they stepped up and let themselves be used in this way as guinea pigs to help promote the research and the science, I think is really a remarkable testament to the way that there was a lot of selflessness and giving at that time.
As you can see, I've plonked a dirty great big microscope on the desk between us, Jeremy, and I want you to look down and look at a virus, 1918, well, if you like, and tell us what a virus actually is.
Sure. We know that there are bacteria. Those are living in the sense that we usually think of a living organism in terms of respirating and so forth. Virus particles are about 20 times smaller than a bacteria. They've been with us for hundreds of millions of years, and there's really a debate as to whether you would even call such a thing alive. Because a virus is really just a bag of chemicals. It's a membrane which surrounds genes inside, and that particle can do nothing by itself. In order to replicate, it needs to invade another cell and replicate
so
there.
It's so, not self-replicating, it's got to find a host.
That's right. It has to find a host. And that's why I always hesitate when calling it, when saying that we actually have a live version of the flu virus. But we'll use that shorthand for now because it is convenient. But yes, the virus is a bag of particles waiting for an opportunity to invade a cell. If you look at the flu virus, it is it's really a beach ball shaped virus with proteins sticking up on the surface. And in the middle, there are 8 genes, and this flu virus wanders around, trying whenever it can to invade a host and replicate and spread.
We've reported over the years outbreaks of avian flu, swine flu, among others. Why haven't they been as deadly as the Spanish flu? No, let me put another question to you before we tackle that. It's a misnomer to call it Spanish, isn't it?
Yes, we to this day call it the Spanish flu. There have been books published about the Spanish flu on the title, but it is a misnomer. And the reason that it was come to be known as the Spanish flu is this: during the early stages of the flu epidemic, there was a sort of a tacit agreement between governments and newspapers not to really mention the flu in any kind of front page. And the reason was to try and keep people's morale up. After all, the world was entering its fourth year of this awful world war, and then to tell people that there's a deadly flu pandemic around was certainly something that would have made people's morale dip even further. So in most Western countries, the flu was reported, but it was reported in a sort of a mild way, deep inside the newspaper. But during the Great War,
I had no idea it was subject to censorship, a sort of notice of the time.
Yeah, I don't think it was censorship in the way we think about it today, but it was an editorial decision to place the information deeper in the paper.
Well, I grew up in journalism at a time when suicides weren't reported. You know, because it was known dimly that there'd be other attempts inspired by suicide reports. So it was an era of not fake news, but no news.
Right. And the same is true, by the way, of suicide today, that the way it's reported has been shown to influence people thinking about or even committing suicide. But to get back to Spain, so Spain was neutral in the war. So there was, if you like, a more open press. And so the press there began to talk about the flu that was affecting people in Spain in a much more open way. And so the first reports of flu originated in Spain, even though the disease did not originate in Spain. And it originated in Spain because of the more free press at the time. So the moniker of Spanish Lady stuck, even though the disease most certainly did not originate in Spain.
Now, okay, avian flu, swine flu, are they also misnomers or accurate?
No, those are actually very accurate. And the reason that they're so accurate is that influenza, or at least the influenza that can become a pandemic influenza, is a particle that equally attacks birds and other mammals. So the influenza virus is the type of virus that it is called influenza A, and that attacks humans and also wild aquatic birds. So we share this with birds, that the flu can actually really go from one species to the other. And calling it swine flu or bird flu is actually in many ways accurate. I mean, we know, for instance, that the 1918 virus originated in birds. Somewhere along the line, it infected a mammalian host, we're not sure which, and then jumped into humans. So while these viruses are given those names, I think it suggests more of the origin of those viruses. So call something swine flu means that the virus shares some features of the particle that invades pigs. So those are fairly correct, but the virus is not in any way to be thought of as exactly the same, because the virus has to mutate in order to affect humans if originally the host that it was comfortable in were birds.
Tonight, Elinel, is, as I said earlier, Elinel, because we're discussing the deadliest disease in history. My guest is Jeremy Brown, Director of the Office of Emergency Care Research at the National Institute of Health, and the book, Influenza, The Quest to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History, published by our friends at Text. The most frightening outburst or outbreak of recent times has to be Ebola. Now, the threat of the outbreak was terrifying, but it was mostly contained to poorest rural areas in Africa. Is the best protection against a pandemic to live in a rich Western nation with all that comes with it, medical infrastructure and so forth?
Well, that's a question that we should really tease apart. In some ways, the living in a rich Western city is actually a very poor defense against the flu, because we know that the flu spreads from person to person. And so if you are living isolated, perhaps in a rural area or on the farm, and do not have contact with people from the outside of your homestead, well, that's going to protect you in a much greater way against the flu. But we do know that that Western medicine has really made some wonderful advances. So if you think about what was happening back in 1918, there were no intensive care units. There were no antibiotics to treat the secondary infections from the flu that are really the cause of most of the deaths. There were no infectious disease experts. There were no ventilators. And so while we said at the beginning that the vast majority of people are never going to need these interventions, we do have them ready. And so the other sort of answer to your question is yes, living in a technology-rich society which hopefully has good access to healthcare is likely to pull you through the flu if you develop a complication. And indeed, I opened the book with a story of a woman, a mother of two, Autumn, who came down with the flu overnight, ended up being on heart-lung bypass machine for several weeks until she finally recovered. And there is no question that she would have died had there not been this opportunity to save her life by putting her on a heart-lung machine. So we have a lot to offer in Western medicine.
Provided an outbreak doesn't occur during Donald Trump's government shutdown, one might think. Okay, we're told every year to get a vaccine shot. Worth doing?
The vaccine is certainly worth doing in high-risk groups, and those high-risk groups include children, the elderly, pregnant women, and people with chronic lung conditions, or like asthma, perhaps, and people who are immunocompromised, so people who have gotten chemotherapy or people who are on steroids and so forth. There is no question that it helps prevent the flu becoming a serious disease in those high-risk groups. And everybody who is in one of those high-risk groups should make sure that they're vaccinated each season. The question about whether the vaccine does a lot in the other populations, let's call them the otherwise healthy adults, that question is actually answered in a couple of different ways. So in the US, for example, the Centers for Disease Control has sort of suggested that every person over the age of 6 months in the US get vaccinated with the vaccine to prevent the flu. In the United Kingdom and in Europe, the message is that only the high-risk groups should get vaccinated, and for everybody else, if you want the vaccine, go talk to your doctor about it, but it's certainly not recommended. And the reason that it's not recommended in that otherwise healthy population is that it's a marginal benefit there. And so it doesn't seem in many ways to be worth the effort to go out and vaccinate that population where it's of marginal benefit.
This is Ilya Nell on RN, and you can listen on the ABC Listen app or download the podcast, and we're hearing the wise words of Jeremy Brown. Are the anti-vaxxers crusading on flu injections?
I think they are so wrapped up in the routine vaccinations that the flu vaccine hasn't sort of been front and center. Although I will share something that I actually only learned recently from a pediatrician friend of mine. Here in the United States, the African American community, for a variety of reasons, very, very good reasons, has been somewhat more suspicious or more reluctant, if you like, to get the flu, to get vaccines in general. And I was speaking to this pediatrician friend of mine who told me that that the vaccine, when he offers the vaccine to his African American patients, he often sees that there is this reluctance because it is sort of clumped together with other vaccines and the suspicion. And so he's very he really tries to emphasize that this vaccine is different, and that it has to be given every year, and the reason why it has to be given every year, and has had some success, but you do have to sort of go that extra mile with certain populations. The anti-vaxxers, as I said, have not targeted this. They are spending their time, misguided time, targeting the routine vaccinations in general.
Jeremy, let's hope they're not listening to the program. Now, Tamiflu. There's a lot of debate surrounding flu drugs like this. Do they actually work? What's the scientific basis?
So Tamiflu is a drug that was developed in the 60s, but really only came to the market in the 1990s. And it is a clever drug. It prevents the baby virus particles. Once the virus infects the lung cell, it reproduces by hijacking the machinery, and then the baby virus particles make their way to the surface of the lung cell, where they remain tethered, and you have to get a certain protein to cut the rope, as it were, and let the baby virus particles free. So Tamiflu is a clever drug, and it prevents the rope from being cut, and therefore it prevents the flu virus particles from shedding and sort of being released. So that's how it works. The problem with Tamiflu is that its abilities to influence the outcome of the disease have been vastly, vastly overstated. There was a long debate, not really a debate, but a long effort, as I'm outlining this in detail in the book, to actually get the companies who were behind Tamiflu to release all the research data that they had in order for doctors to actually be able to estimate how good the drug is. And we have had outbreaks in the US, in Canada, in the UK, and I suspect in Australia too, in which the drug was thought to, you know, was people were encouraged to get the drug when they really should not be encouraged to do so. Famously, in 2009 in Boston, a law firm called Ropes and Gray got doctors to write prescriptions for all of their lawyers, even though they were healthy. The idea was that you would stock up with Tamiflu and take it to prevent the illness. And this caused a great outrage in the US because it was thought to be an example of the haves versus the have-nots, that people with access to medical care could get Tamiflu while everybody else had to sort of wait in line. The truth of the matter is it was not a good medical decision to do that. And the best evidence that we have for Tamiflu is that it reduces the length of symptoms by a little less than a day, perhaps on average about 12 to 15 hours. And that's only if you take it within the first 48 hours of the illness. So it shortens the symptoms by about a day. That comes at the expense of some side effects. And the drug has never been shown to either reduce the hospitalization rate or reduce the complication rate.
Jeremy, you write that in the modern medical system, the job of an epidemiologist is extremely difficult because it's hard to trace the outbreak of flu. Doctors don't run full flu tests, for example.
That's right. When I was in the emergency department treating patients with flu, I would nearly always make a clinical diagnosis, meaning I don't need a test to tell me what I think the patient has when I'm convinced that that's what the patient has in front of me. And so if I or other emergency physicians would diagnose a patient with influenza, we would be very unlikely to get a test because it would just confirm what we know and it would be a waste of money and we wouldn't do anything different. So from an individual patient perspective, getting a rapid flu test, it doesn't really do a whole lot if you're pretty convinced that that's what they have. And again, we're talking here about otherwise healthy people. But so the flu swab isn't sort of helpful clinically, but it is helpful epidemiologically in that it can tell the people who will look at the population as a whole, not individual patients. It can tell them what kind of flu is out there, in what proportions, how many flu tests are positive and how many negative. And that is extremely important in planning for the flu, in understanding what the current flu outbreak is doing, and in some instances, figuring out how we might change the vaccine going forward. And that's really one very important thing that happens worldwide, is that there are stations across the world that do routinely collect swabs, and they analyze what strains are out there, and that helps us to decide what should go into the next round of flu vaccine based on sort of the most common strains that are out there. So flu swabs, very important for a population, much less so for an individual.
You tell us that we can have too little information on flu, but also too much information. Remind us briefly about Alaska in 92.
Yes, there was an outbreak of influenza in the summer of 1992 in Alaska that was at first very worrying. And the Centers for Disease Control sent a field agent to Alaska. I actually spoke to him and he went to Alaska and investigated what was going on. And it turned out that there was no epidemic at all. And that's why people haven't heard of it. What was happening was that the single physician was sending lots and lots and lots and lots of flu swabs, most of which were negative. But every now and again, a patient would come back positive, whereas other physicians wouldn't do that. They would simply make a clinical diagnosis and leave it there. And so what was happening was that in one practice, flu was being detected because they were doing a whole lot more tests than everybody else. And there's an example of why you have to be very careful about understanding what a positive test means, and certainly have to put it in perspective when you think about what else is out there and how many negative tests aren't there.
Jeremy, you're a fascinating fellow. Are we ready for the next big pandemic?
This is a question that comes up so often, and in the book I describe really two approaches to this question. The first are the pessimists who say the reason that we didn't have a pandemic this season is that we just dodged the bullet. All the conditions are there. We live in close quarters with each other, and public transport, on aeroplanes, the virus can be across the world in just a few hours. And so the reason that we haven't had a pandemic in a particular season is just good fortune, and there is bound to be one soon. The optimist sees things differently. They say there hasn't been an outbreak of anywhere near the proportions of 1918. We have improved medical care, as we've discussed. So there's reason to be optimistic.
Jeremy, I want to end on an optimistic note. I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Thank you immensely. Jeremy Brown, Director of the Office of Emergency Care Research at the National Institutes of Health. The book, published by Text, Influenza, The Quest to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History.